Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. And a beautiful Shabbat it is. You know, that a passage from the book of Revelation, tough passage about what happens at the end of the age, I just want to say, tuck it away. It's important, but tuck it away. Because in the meantime, God has called us to life, and we're privileged to have speakers who just love to live life and are learning and know how to live it well. And we're privileged to have our rabbinic intern with us today, Nathan Morell. He's going to bring us a drash from the Torah. And so, Nathan, come and speak to us.
Thank you. I brought many books with me because, like, that's what like any good Jew would do, right? I just didn't bring different versions, so I can't help you there. It's funny, actually. When I was preparing for the sermon, my desk was just like, there's one day where I went home after doing like all this research, and then I came back the next day, and there's just like book upon book. It's like, here's the BDB, here's the Tanakh, here's my, you know, abridged version of this and this, and it's just like all laid out, and I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, but it's really cool because it's a great feeling to be able to go through some of the texts and just like, I mean, really dig, because I think that, you know, there's just so much there. I wanted to start with talking about Purim. Purim, as you know, is a story that everything's backwards. Everything is completely flip-flop or topsy-turvy. That's a great word for it. I'm going to just mention a few things that I find kind of interesting about Purim, and really the Megillah or the story of Esther, right? There are some key Jewish values that are missing in the story of Purim. For example, Esther and Mordecai, they have no real recollection of family. Esther's parents, both of them are dead, and it seems there's just no mention of their family or family support. And family, of course, is a key Jewish value. The next is there's little mention of the nation of Israel. They're in a different land, and the relationship, it's kind of interesting. It's Z's. It's all quiet. It's, you know, it's like it's not very existent. And then, of course, intermarriage with like a pagan king. That's another kind of, you know, that's another thing that's like, oh, when you think about it. And then on top of that, talking about the queens, there's this interesting idea about the queens. So Queen Vashti is banished because of her modesty. She won't approach the king because she's modest and he's drinking during his, you know, party. But Esther enters the king's presence without being invited. Talk about guts, but then is gained favor because of it. So that's totally backwards. Next is the supreme ruler himself. The king, who seems to be in control and ruling, is really ruled by alcohol or wine, circumstances, and his advisors. And there are the typical things, the things that pop out. The gallows, made for Mordecai, you know, but used for Haman. And Mordecai, who's supposed to die, gets to live and take Haman's position as viceroy. And then to top it all off, God's name is completely absent from the text, yet the Jewish people are still somehow saved by a miraculous turn of events that the rabbis ascribe to God, and we'll see why later. Again, this week is a special Shabbat, Shabbat Zachor, the Shabbat of remembrance. And the Shabbat before Purim, we have a special Mavtir reading, as Rabbi Nathan noted, about are found in Devarim 25:17 through 19. This reading, as you heard, recalls God's commandment for Israel to never forget what Amalek and the Amalekites did to them as they came from Egypt. So today, I would like to start with remembering what Amalek, or who Amalek is, and why what he did was so bad, and what that kind of means for us as followers of Mashiach. So we read from Exodus, actually going back to the original story in Exodus 17, 8 through 16, the original account of the attack of the Amalekites against Israel. So here I quote, "Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. And so Moses said to Joshua, choose men from us to go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself at the top of the hill with my staff of God in my hand. And Joshua did as Moses told him, and he fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So when it came about, when Moses held his hand up, Israel prevailed. But when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were very heavy. And then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Then Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. And thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then verse 14 says, then the Lord said to Moses, write this in the book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and then named it, the Lord is my banner. And he said, the Lord has sworn, and the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So again, what I want to point here is not the whole story about the rod and the staff, but the idea that Amalek attacked Israel, and then Israel prevailed, and God said, you will remember this. So some important background to what is going on here, kind of a quick aside, but very important, is that Amalek is the son of Eliphaz, who was the son of Esau. So here we have this family dynamic between Jacob and his descendants, or really Israel and descendants, and Esau and their descendants, right? And they're kind of colliding. So I want to point out that the Amalekites are attacking Israel right after they've come out of Egypt, right after they've come out of slavery. At this point, Israel was foreigners wandering through the wilderness, and they were completely unorganized, basically. They didn't have their structure of the 12 tribes with the tabernacle. And they were still making their way to Sinai. And along comes Amalek and his people. And there's no recollection of the Israel attacking Amalek and his people. But really, the attack is unprovoked. So Israel's walking through when Amalek comes and attacks them. On top of that, again, they just got out of slavery. And they're in the wilderness, and they're foreigners. So you see a pattern here. And again, the Maftir kind of underscores this, the nature of the attack. Quoting Devarim 25:17-19, you must never forget what the people of Amalek did to you as you came from Egypt. Remember that they fought with you and struck you down, those who were faint and weary and lagging behind, with no respect or fear of God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies in the promised land, you are to utterly destroy the name of Amalek from under heaven. Never forget this. So again, Amalek and his people unprovokingly attacks Israel when she is faint, tired, unorganized from journeying. And again, they're foreigners walking through a strange land. And the Amalekites lay siege to her without any reason. But furthermore, they attack the rear. They don't attack the strong men of Israel. They attack the stragglers, the weary, the old, the people who are not well defended and could not fight for themselves. By now, the conclusion is, wow, these are an evil people. Like, who would do this? This is kind of like that parable I was just reading about. Yeshua was talking about the man who just gets attacked on the side of the road. And then some people come by and just completely ignore him. When it's like, who is my neighbor? You know, it's like, that man is your neighbor. And here comes the Amalekites, and they just slaughter him, basically. But the weakest of them, like his children and his father-in-law, who like can barely walk with a cane. Like, that's evil, right? And so what I'm getting at here is, in the verse in the Hebrew, it says, Velo Yareh Elohim. Which means, and he did not fear God, referring to Amalek. I think this tiny phrase is key to understanding the whole passage, its connection to Purim, and is also key to understanding something fundamental to the kingdom of God and our place on earth. Velo Yareh Elohim, and he did not fear God. Or did not respect him, did not give awe or reverence to him. Well, we know that fearing God, well, first of all, what is fearing God? And the answer is, we know that it's important because we say it every time we enter God's house. We say, Ma Tovu. Or to just read the English, to skip to the good stuff, we say, How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. As for me, in your great loving kindness, I will come into your house. I will bow down in your holy temple in awe of you, or fear. But Yiratecha, Yira, or Yare, velo Yare Elohim, and he did not fear. But Yiratecha, in fear of you. You see the connection? Yare in Hebrew is the root word for fear, or awe, or reverence. And so again, from Matovu, we understand that fearing God is important. But I want to draw a further correlation about fear and connecting it to this Maftir portion. In Deuteronomy, it's clear that Amalek doesn't fear God. He doesn't fear God. And then he attacks the stragglers, defenseless, and the people who are helpless. So there's a link between fear of God or reverence of God and not attacking those who are less fortunate, the defenseless, or the people who simply need help. So therefore, Amalek's lack of reverence for God leads him to attacking the helpless, to not caring that they were in need. And we can expect that those who fear God would do the opposite, right? Those who respect him would uphold the helpless, the defenseless, and the stragglers. So a great example of this correlation or this idea is the Parsha, or found in Parsha Kedushim, which is really God talking to Israel and saying, be holy for I am holy. It's considered, among Jewish sages, it's considered like the heart of Torah. Be holy for I am holy, right? And what is to be holy? To love your neighbor as yourself. That's kind of the summation of Kedushim. But how does this relate to fearing God? Well, the commandments that follow in the Parsha, there's kind of a rhythm to it. I'll quote from Leviticus 19:32-33, and you'll start to see the correlations. You shall give due honor and respect to the elderly, and you shall fear your God. I am Adonai your God. So here we have the elderly, again, people who deserve respect, and also they're people who may not be able to walk the fastest to services. So again, they're in this position of need, and God says, you are to respect them, and you are to fear me. So again, there's that connection of fearing God and respecting those in need. And then verse 33, do not take advantage of the foreigners in your land. Do not wrong them. They must be treated like any other citizens. Love them as yourself, for remember that you too were foreigners in the land of Egypt. I am Adonai your God. So again, the foreigners, the people who really need help. And again, those two verses follow right after fear your God. So again, fearing God is respecting those in need, and in this case, the elderly and the foreigner. But why? Well, because the God of the universe, as Psalm 68:5-6 states, is a father of the fatherless and a judge for the widows, is God in his holy habitation. Right, his holy habitation, Ma Tovu, your sanctuary is a place for the fatherless, for the widows, for the people who just really need a lot of help in life, you know? But furthermore, for the people who don't get that. And then the following verse, God makes a home for the lonely. He leads out the prisoners into prosperity. Only the rebellious dwell in a parched land. I mean, beautiful, beautiful words. That's kind of sowing this connection. So how are we supposed to treat them like God does, right? With love, with respect, and also fairness. This is something that is very important about fear of God, that it's not just treating these people kindly, but it's also not taking advantage of them in any situation, treating them fairly. Because really, as Proverbs 22:2 states, underscore this, the rich and the poor have a common bond. The Lord is the maker of them all, end quote, right? We are all God's people. We are all God's children. And it is especially important to remember those who are easy to forget about, or that they too are made in the image of God. So we see this, that the commandment of Amalek and Devarim is actually right after the verse that talks about fairness in business. Why? Because you should be fair to those people who you could easily take advantage of in business. Furthermore, James really talks great about this. James 2, 1 through 9 states, "My brothers and sisters, believers in our own glorious Yeshua HaMashiach must not show favoritism. Suppose that a man comes into your synagogue wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man enters in filthy old clothes. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, 'Here is a good seat for you,' but say to the poor man, 'You stand there,' or 'Sit at the floor at my feet,' have you not discriminated amongst yourselves and become judges of evil thoughts? Listen, my dear brothers and sisters. Has not God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom that he has promised to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor. It is not the rich who are exploiting you? Are they not the ones who are dragging you into the court? Are they not the ones who are blaspheming your noble name and the name of him who you worship? If you really keep the royal instruction found in Scripture, 'Love your neighbor as yourself,' you are doing right. But if you show favoritism, you sin and are convicted by the law as lawbreakers." End quote. So again, James is pointing out, also in business, you are to treat these people fairly. You will not take advantage of them. Fearing God is treating people with respect, everyone. Now, it would be nice to stop here and say, okay, this is the end of the story, but of course it's not, because we have Purim, right? Because the story goes on with Amalek, right? As we heard in our Haftarah portion that, I'll just draw the connection for you. The Maftar reading is connected to Purim because, as the Talmud notes, Haman is Amalek's direct descendant through the king, Agag, who wasn't killed by Saul. So there's our Haftarah portion. So Haman and Amalek are direct descendants, which also makes Haman a direct descendant of Esau. So again, we have this family dynamics of Jacob and Israel versus Esau, Amalek, and Haman, right? But this version of the struggle between Israel and Amalek's ancestor, Haman, we have a list of topsy-turvy circumstances or things in the story that appear different and seem to end up backwards. So those list of few things that I talked about before, right? Where Mordecai is brought up and lifted high and Haman actually ends up dying. And the lowest people in the land, the Jewish people, the foreigners, they're saved. So we have these themes kind of floating around, right? About, again, the fear of God and the lowliest. Well, all these, to me, represent God working in circumstances that seem like unlikely places for him to work. Esther means hidden, which is the whole shebang, right? This is the whole, this is it about Purim. That God's name is not found in the scroll of Esther, but because it's hidden, because he's working in through these circumstances, through that fabric. So, picking up on our theme of fearing God and taking care of the needy, the backwardness of the situation also reminds me of the backwardness of Yeshua in the kingdom of heaven and how it appears to our senses and our eyes, which I think is a collision of paradigms, right? There's heaven, which the lowliest are lifted up, and then there's our world. And these two paradigms are kind of clashing in Esther. We have Mordecai, the guy who's tearing down the foreigners, but then God comes through circumstance and lifts them up. What this points to is the pattern of God's behavior and his paradigm that he operates out of, that the underdog can also be found in the kingdom of heaven. And actually, I wanted to read a story from Talmud found in the introduction written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of the Pirkei Avot, which I think underscores all of what Yeshua represents as a Messiah and talks greatly about the kingdom of heaven and really kind of illuminates what it means for God's economy in this kind of situation. So the Talmud reports a remarkable incident by Rabbi Yosef, son of Rabbi Joshua ben Levi, who became very ill. It was thought that his soul vanished in the world to come in his near-death experience. And when he survived, his father asked him what he had seen in the next world. Rabbi Yosef replied, "I saw a topsy-turvy world. The high ones are low, and the low ones are high." Rabbi Joshua responded, "My son, you have seen things clearly." Rabbi Yosef had been surprised to find that the people who were the most esteemed in the world were the least esteemed in the world to come, and that those who seemed to be unimportant to this world were considered very significant in the world to come. Earthly life is filled with illusions. The true value of individuals is seldom perceived correctly. It is popularly thought that the most powerful, influential, and wealthy people, and the ones who are the most successful, or the kings in the highest positions, you know, Amalek, Haman, etc., are going to be the most successful in the kingdom of heaven. But in the eyes of God, the one who fully comprehends each person's value, because we are all made in the image of God, Proverbs 22:2, this frequently may not be the case, that God has his own standards for judging human beings, and that these standards are not related to earthly signs of success. Rather, God values the souls of those who live good and righteous, pious lives. These souls often belong to those who are not deemed to be successful by materialistic human standards. But in the world to come, where absolute truth prevails, the illusions are broken. Clarity is achieved. The true value of the individual is demonstrated. Or, as his father said to him, "My son, you have seen things clearly." So both Purim and Amalek, those stories, they lead to justice in this world. But what about the circumstances that end differently? What about all those voices in the times where they don't get heard, where they don't succeed, when they aren't lifted up? Which, again, we're going to turn back to James 5:4-7, which says, "For listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you have cheated their pay. Their cries have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have spent your years here on earth having fun, satisfying your every whim, and now your fat hearts are ready for slaughter. You have condemned and killed good men, men who had no power to defend themselves against you. Now, as for you, dear brothers, who are waiting for the Lord's return, be patient like a farmer who waits until the autumn for his precious harvest to ripen. Yes, be patient and take courage, for the coming of the Lord is near." End quote. Which this idea, kind of connecting, I think serves really well to our Besorah portion. I was trying to find a connection between Revelation, and I think Rabbi Nathan found a great one. And I also do want to bring out one that I think is important. And I think as I read it, it will kind of become clear. "And when he broke the fifth seal, I saw an altar. Underneath it, the souls of those who had been martyred for preaching the word of God, for being faithful in their wrestling. They called loudly to the Lord and said, 'O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long will it be before you judge the people of the earth for what they have done to us? When will you avenge our blood against those on earth?' White robes were given to each of them, and they were told to rest a little longer until their other brothers, fellow servants of Yeshua, had been martyred on the earth and joined them. I watched as he broke the sixth seal, and there was a vast earthquake, and the sun became dark like black cloth, and the moon was blood red. Then the stars of heaven appeared to be falling on earth like green fruit from a fig trees, buffeted by the mighty winds. And the starry heavens disappeared as though it rolled up like a scroll and taken away. Every mountain in the island shook and shifted. The kings of the earth, the world's leaders, the rich men, the high-ranking military officers, and all men, great and small, slave and free, hid themselves in the caves, the rocks of the mountains, and cried to the mountains to crush them. 'Fall on us,' they pleaded. 'Hide us from the face of the one sitting on the throne and from the anger of the Lamb, because the great day of the Lord of the anger has come, and who can survive it?'" So again, what do we have here? This is the answer. What happens when something like Purim goes wrong. The helpless, the people who are most in need get slaughtered or cut off or etc. Well, we have our answer in our Besorah portion, right? Because what happens? All kings, everyone, Amalek, Haman, Esau, everyone, everyone wicked, everyone righteous will have to respond to God in the end. And so, to summarize, when we are commanded to remember what Amalek did to our ancestors, to never forget, we are being commanded to remember not just one great evil in the world, but that Amalek is the sworn enemy of Israel because he represents something that opposes God and his people. That Israel fundamentally as a nation to be a holy people, separate and distinct from the world's ways of veins, which seems backwards. The world's ways of the weakest die and have no voice. God opposes this, and so does his people. We, as Jews, are safekeepers and followers of Mashiach, especially followers of Mashiach, are safekeepers of this, of the oppressed, the downtrodden, the unremembered, the forgotten. Because we, unlike those against us, fear God. Summation of Kohelet says, right, the wisest words, and I will leave you with this. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments. Because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether good or evil. And I will leave you with that. Shabbat shalom.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.